Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Public records can tell a story, an evidence-based story that can broaden our understanding of the past and how the past relates to the here and now. At the moment, data is being compiled from Fayette County historical property records to provide a more complete account of what was once a major economic driver in Lexington, the slave trade. Reverend Shay Brown and Dr. Vanessa Holden have been doing the research, and they are Dr. Gerald Smith's latest guests for our series on racial justice and equality in America.
Reverend Shay Brown is a deputy clerk in the Land Records Department of the Fayette County Clerk's Office and has been in that position for over 22 years. He currently serves as Special Projects Deputy Clerk for the office and is one of the directors of the Digital Access Project. He also serves as the pastor of the Pleasant Valley Baptist Church in Lancaster, Kentucky. Reverend Brown has taught the Introduction to Real Estate Law class at Sullivan University, and he has also been a volunteer instructor for the Vault class at the University of Kentucky Department of Law. Our second guest for the program is Dr. Vanessa Holden. She is an associate professor in the Department of History at the University of Kentucky and director of the Central Kentucky Slavery Initiative that is based in the Commonwealth Institute for Black Studies at UK. Dr. Holden is a scholar whose research focuses on African-American women and slavery in the antebellum South. And her book, Surviving Southampton, African-American Women and the Resistance in Nat Turner's Community, just won the James H. Broussard Best First Book Prize from the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic. So congratulations to you, Dr. Holden, on that prestigious award.
Thank you.
Again, I'd like to welcome both of you, Reverend Shay Brown and Dr. Vanessa Holden.
Thank you.
And I want to begin our conversation with you, Reverend Brown, discussing the Digital Access Project. So exactly what is the Digital Access Project? Why is it important? And where exactly is the project taking place?
Digital Access Project is short word for it is DAP, D-A-P. And it's a project where it's bringing to light more than 60,000 pages of our Fayette County property records spanning from the late 1700s through 1865. Many of these records identify names of enslaved people who were sold, purchased, and even emancipated, deed mortgage records of enslaved people who were used as collateral to secure debt and wills and estate appraisements, settlements, inventory, and other probate records, including enslaved people as a part of an estate. Kentucky County Court clerk records will reveal that black humans were classified as personal property and therefore were sold, transferred, conveyed, auctioned off, mortgaged as security, appraised as inventory, and even bestowed to another person as a gift upon a testator's death in a last will and testament. So with this project known as DAP, our job is to make the public have access and visibility digitally to the information found within the records at the county clerk's office from that time period and the future to come, and it will provide an opportunity for the public to utilize these digital records to explore effective cultural enrichment conversations for establishing racial reconciliation and to gain exposure to the history surrounding racial barriers here in Lexington, Kentucky, and to help educate and enlighten the public on the current growing concerns associated with racial injustice and inequality. And where does this project taking place? It's taking place right here at the Fayette County Clerk's Office, 162 East Main, Lexington, Kentucky, during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. We kicked off on May the 23rd of 2022 by digitizing our first general index book to deeds and mortgages. And we will continue this project until each page from all 137 books identified as deeds, wills, burnt records, and their indexes are digitized.
So this project involves a very impressive partnership. What are some of the agencies and institutions or organizations that are working with you?
So thankful with the partnership that we have formed, especially with the University of Kentucky's Commonwealth Institute of Black Studies, the Lexington Black Prosperity Initiative. Of course, our office, the Fayette County Clerk's Office, under the leadership of Don W. Blevins, Jr. There was a fund provided by Bluegrass Community Foundation and the Knight Foundation, donor of Vice Charitable Fund, which allows us to begin digitizing these records as well as completing the digitization, plus down the line other transcriptions and metadata for the community to be able to have access to.
Well, Dr. Holden, one of the main highlights of this project is the information that will be gleaned regarding Black enslavement. Was Black enslavement extensive in both rural and urban communities in Lexington and Central Kentucky?
Well, the short answer is yes, it was extensive. And I think that the key here, and one of the pieces that this project will help reveal, is that often when folks hear slavery, in their mind they imagine a large plantation farming usually cotton. They think of enslavers who held hundreds of people as slaves. And when it comes to places like Kentucky, where it was far more common for enslavers to have much smaller slave holdings, sometimes that historic memory kind of fades away, that you know, numbers and the number of enslaved people directly correlates to slavery's importance. And that's just not true in Kentucky. Yes, overwhelmingly, enslavers here in Kentucky held smaller numbers of enslaved people in their households as slaves, but slavery and the business of slavery was key to bolstering the Commonwealth's economic prosperity. And African Americans' contributions, both their contribution of labor, of forced labor, and their intellectual contributions and cultural contributions to the Commonwealth cannot be, there's no way to overstate those contributions. So sometimes, you know, folks get tripped up on, you know, their misconception of what slavery must have looked like, when in reality, enslaved people were everywhere in the Commonwealth, and their contributions cannot be ignored.
So researching these documents, just kind of extending what you've already shared, how will the project advance our understanding of the enslaved experience in this area? For example, you know, what do you think it will reveal to us about the domestic slave trade in Central Kentucky?
Well, historians have known for a long time that Lexington was one of the most, if not the most important, far northern node of the internal slave trade. And that trade took off after the Atlantic trade closed in 1808. And suddenly, enslavers in the newly opened plantation districts of the Deep South could only import new enslaved laborers from other slaveholding states. So for a long time, that, you know, general information, you know, that's been the fact that, you know, if Kentucky shows up in folks' books and manuscripts, that's the fact that's there. But the real ins and outs of the internal slave trade are something that historians are really beginning to dig into. And here in Lexington, here in Kentucky, understanding what kind of work enslaved people were doing here and understanding the ways that going into the business of slavery was really bolstering the economy really expands our understanding of slavery's importance and, by extension, enslaved people's importance. So, for example, if you follow the pathways of the internal slave trade, you kind of always know where you're going to end up. You start in Lexington, you walk down through Tennessee, and end up on a cotton plantation in Alabama or Mississippi. But if you follow the money, then you end up in some really interesting places because a whole bunch of industries had to exist to make that trade possible. And enslaved people were sometimes forced to work in those industries. So everyone from the blacksmith who was making chains to link coffles of people together, to the steamboat driver, to the local court system, to the deeds office that had to record these transactions, all of them were making money off of slavery in ways that folks often don't really think of as directly part of the trade. The one thing these deed books are going to allow us to trace is, where are all those transactions happening? How are folks moving enslaved property to bolster their financial future?
So, Reverend Brown, what do you believe the project will uncover about free Black people in Lexington?
Well, there's three things about that it would uncover. First of all, we'll see where free Black people went from enslavement to emancipation and entitlement. They went from economic oppression to economic opportunity. And then let us not simply just rest on the mythical fact that all property was just given or handed to Black people by white people after the Civil War. No, in fact, Black people worked hard, as Dr. Holden emphasized, they worked hard to earn and purchase property through service provided in the war or as working for a slave owner. And the project will show through deed records that, yes, Black people acquired and sold real property as owners after the Civil War. They were given to marriage. They were educated enough to understand real property concepts such as having a survey plat done, having deeds and wills. But although that Kentucky had Black freedom, there still remained the struggles for free Black people. For example, name a few, there were deed restrictions limiting where Black people could live in Lexington, in certain areas in Lexington, Kentucky. There were separate records between based on ethnicity of color. And somewhere around the 1900s, there was the fear of recording documents in county offices due to systematic racism from elected officials, or there was the lack of education or proper legal representations when executing legal documents to be recorded in county offices, which leads to a term today, what we call heirs property, where you have a bundle of heirs owning property and undivided interest, and they don't have fee simple ownership to get a mortgage on the property, to rightfully sell the property without multiple heirs signing off, or to make improvements to land, all due to the lack of education and misrepresentation of the legal community.
So, Dr. Holden, you've described the Digital Access Project as, quote, as part of a long tradition of memory keeping, community curation, and intentional preservation. So would you like to elaborate on that statement?
In my time as a professional historian, I've seen and watched multiple times in multiple contexts, and even in my own experience as a Black woman in America, African Americans being told that they can't know their history, you know, that we just don't have the records, we just can't know the past. And yet, in the community I grew up in the Black communities that I've been welcomed into in different places in the country where I've lived, that's simply not true. There are always memory keepers. And while maybe, you know, textbook histories or the official accounts don't recognize that as true history work, within the community, folks know. And so, you know, as somebody who's coming from out of state, I've just been in Kentucky for 5 years now, I'm very well aware that I might have some fancy letters after my name, and I worked for those, but that does not really hold a candle to the long struggle to keep Black history alive within communities here. And so I've had the honor and privilege of working with local descendants of the ancestors who are enumerated in these documents, and to work with folks who have done everything from preserving local cemeteries to auditing local historic sites to doing their own genealogy, who have long known these histories. And so it is always at the forefront of my mind that those memory keepers, that those community curators, that those folks who are, you know, putting things aside and making photocopies to keep for their own information, that they really be in the foreground here. Because sure, my level of expertise can lend a hand to this, but the work we're doing with DAP is part of a much longer struggle And it's really important to me to honor that and to do more listening than talking.
Well, in closing, Reverend Brown, how can members of the community support this project, and where can they go for more information?
People need more information, they can always email me at the Fayette County Clerk's Office. It's fccprojects@fayettecountyclerk.com, fccprojects@fayettecountyclerk.com, or to make a charitable contribution or stock donation or larger gifts, contact the Bluegrass Community Foundation at area code 859-225-3343.
All right. Thank you. That's Reverend Shea Brown, Special Projects Deputy Clerk in the Land Records Department of the Fayette County Clerk's Office, and Dr. Vanessa Holden, Associate Professor in the Department of History at the University of Kentucky and Director of the Central Kentucky Slavery Initiative. Thanks for joining us, Reverend Brown and Dr. Holden.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
It's tough to be a parent of school-age kids these days. It's tough to be a teacher of those kids. And it's tough to get everybody under the same page around the best interests of all concerned. For the latest in our series on education in Kentucky, Gil Hunter looks into a program that helps busy parents and teachers work together.
Brooke Gill is the Senior Director for Family Engagement Policy and Practice with the Pritchard Committee. And she joins me today to talk about healthy, even difference-making relationships between families and schools. Brooke, thank you for talking with me today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So start on a big picture here. What is family engagement supposed to look like in schools? And then maybe a logical follow-up to that, what does it actually look like?
It's all about relationships. What it looks like in schools right now, we can get caught up in event attendance. And sometimes we miss out on the main objective being relationship building. So it's about families and teachers and communities and even businesses working together towards student success. So families are talking to teachers about the unique personality traits of their child, you know, what makes them unique, nervous, calm, hyper. And teachers are sharing with families low-cost, no-cost ways that they could support their students learning at home. We see a lot of community and business opportunity, especially in the middle and high school areas. When we're looking at schools that are doing family and community engagement well, these communities are in the schools offering internships, certificate opportunities, mentoring, interviewing experience, and things like that. So we really want to think about kind of like that old, that old adage of it takes a village. That is family engagement. Mm. However, sometimes we get caught in this space of if we call and need the family to come to the school or to show up in some sort of way, whether it be a behavioral issue or the child's grades are slipping, if we call, do they come? And that's really where we want to encourage folks to start building relationships on the front end.
So building relationships and that kind of encouragement to do that, is that where people like you come in to close the gap between what schools are doing and what they actually could do?
It's really hard work. We're asking families and teachers to build relationships, which is hard anyway. And you're talking about two groups of people that are already very busy and stressed.
Right.
And so what we hope to offer with the Kentucky Collaborative are those concrete ways to begin building those relationships. And so I think we have to be empathetic to our teachers when we say, you know, family engagement is so important. You have to partner with the family. You have to partner with the community. And teachers are going, I don't know what that looks like. I agree it's important, but I didn't learn how to do that in school. You know, when we host teacher trainings, one of the first icebreaker questions we'll ask is, how many hours of your teacher preparation program were designated to family engagement best practices?
Mm.
And almost always, everyone in the room says zero. So you put all of these teachers in a classroom, and there's already so much thrown at them, and you're asking them to now engage family, and we haven't given them formal training on what that looks like.
No kidding.
Right. And with the families as well, we're telling families, you know, you're part of your kids' educational success. You can't, you know, lean on just the school to raise the kids. You know, we put all this pressure on families too. And families don't know what that looks like. And so what we try to do through the Kentucky Collaborative is give really simple examples of what we mean by building this relationship. A really simple, concrete idea is just welcoming phone calls. Teachers calling families and welcoming to the school. Hey, I'm so-and-so. I'm going to be your, seventh grader's math teacher. And here's what I really like about teaching. And this is my sixth year of doing it. And just getting to know each other on that human-to-human level, if nothing else, just start building the relationship. And for families, we say, email your kid's teacher. Introduce yourself. Hey, I'm so-and-so. You're going to have my kid next year. Here's some ways that I can support you in the classroom. I can't really attend a lot of the PTA meetings, and I'm not available a lot for some of those evening activities, but here's some gifts or talents that I would love to bring to the classroom. Or, I would love to know how to support my kid's learning. I know he really struggles with homework. Like, make the first move. Mm-hmm. And that really opens the door for teachers to then kind of reciprocate that relationship.
Yeah, I would suspect some parents are much more comfortable with that, or maybe even we say better at that than others. And so you do work with families as well, not just schools?
Right. Yeah, we have tools for families mm-hmm. and understanding the education system. It is really confusing to understand who you're supposed to go to with what questions. I'm sure even for you, having been a teacher and then having daughters in the school system, I even find it confusing with my own kids. And I come from this world.
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember walking in with my girls to their schools, and I'll generalize a bit here to give you this kind of example in my mind anyway. When I walked into their elementary schools, there were lots of families there, lots of parents around, lots of kind of vibrant engagement. When they got to middle school, and use that example of the seventh grade math teacher, there were far fewer families represented at middle school events, so to speak, parent-teacher conferences, whatever it might be. And then kind of broadly, there was almost no parent engagement or family engagement in the high schools. So it seems like there'd be a whole lot of benefit in changing that. So how can, for example, middle schools and high schools change that?
I totally agree with that, seeing that engagement drop off. And it's interesting because it's a little bit of mixed messaging to families. We often, talk about the helicopter parents, and they get a really bad rap. So when you're really engaged in your kid's school and elementary, you may be one of those parents that wants to be really engaged in middle and high school, but you feel like you're supposed to back off a little bit. Mm. And so families think that, oh, hey, my kid needs to be more independent. First of all, the kid doesn't want you at lunch anymore. So, they're not begging you to volunteer in the lunchroom anymore in middle and high school. And you're really getting this message to, step back a little bit and let your child handle their own issues with the teacher, and self-advocate, which is great. But what we have to do in middle and high school is turn family engagement into what it needs to look like next. And so if you're not, reading a book to the class, what we want to see families doing is understanding the value of what they are learning in class. And so if you have a kid that doesn't really know what they want to do after high school, family engagement comes in, and those conversations families are having with their kids at home. We talk a lot about, it really matters how you talk about school to your kid. You can blow off that class. It doesn't really matter. You'll never use that stuff anyway. Whoa. So we want to talk to our students about, hey, if you're interested in going into engineering, here's the things you're going to need to know, which makes this class really important. So having those conversations with middle and high schoolers about their career aspirations is where the family kind of completes that circle. But back to the beginning question, teachers have a hard time knowing, how do I involve the parent in those conversations? So we've got great programming in Kentucky. Two of them are Gear Up and Navigo. And what those programs focus on is the school has on-site ambassadors that work with these students in middle and high school. And they do you know, the tests for what are your assets, what are your strengths, what are your interests. And they've come a long way since you and I probably did them in school, which were like teacher, doctor.
Right. Interest inventories. Lawyer. That was as far as we
went. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. There was like five boxes you could fit in.
Right.
But they've really come a long way in pairing students, their interests and strengths with possible career directions. The next step with that is they then show these kiddos like where in their own backyard could those skills be useful in a field that is in high need of workforce. And so they pair them up with this full circle of like, what is your next step post-secondary look like? Where could you possibly work? What does that salary look like? And oh, by the way, let's meet the person who's in charge of that, at P&G right around the corner. The family component comes in and telling the family, this is what we're telling your student. This is what we're working on. And we're all going to take a tour of a campus or a different business, and families are invited. So it's bringing families along for that exposure of experiences and opportunities more than it is homework help and, you know, lunchroom volunteer.
Yeah. So when we think about bringing families along, I want to maybe take a step back from the level of depth that we've focused on here with teachers and bringing families along in that way. Because part of what I'm kind of thinking about when I'm thinking about family engagement is the work that family resource centers and youth service centers have been around doing for, what, a few decades now, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
Those spaces seem like kind of the more or less traditional home of family engagement. Are those spaces still empowered to help teachers do more to bring families into the conversation and that kind of work you've been describing?
Yeah, absolutely. They're unique to Kentucky, too. I'm not sure everybody realizes that our Family Resource and Youth Service Centers is not something that every state has.
Oh.
And so it's neat when I go to national conferences and in work groups, they envy our, we call them Frisky for short, our Frisky setup, because that is what a lot of states are now trying to build with COVID relief dollars. And so they're trying to put resource staff, community liaisons in schools to help families and students reach some of those community supports that they need, mental health services, basic needs. They really address everything. It's non-academic barriers to learning, but that's really important, non-academic. So those Family Resource Youth Service Centers are not there to help the parents support their child's learning, right? So that piece has to be picked up by the teachers and the administrators. So what can sometimes happen, which if I'm a teacher, I can totally see how this would happen, is that your Frisk becomes the family person, right, in the building. And we subconsciously start to kind of associate all things families with the Frisk coordinator. And they can sometimes end up being the only person that has that deep partnership and relationship with the families. And so what we really want to do with some of the work we're doing through the family-friendly schools and some of our PD is thinking about it's everyone's job, the bus driver, the cafeteria workers, it's everyone's job to know and welcome our families. The Frisk coordinator is there to bring in the community resources and understand those non-academic barriers to success.
Yeah, yeah. Some of my colleagues and I at EKU say that students have to Maslow before they can bloom. And that might be kind of what you're describing there. If we don't take care of those basic needs, then some of that higher order thinking stuff that we aspire to may not matter in the immediate.
Well, I love that you brought up Maslow because you have that belonging block
right
in there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes we just skip right over that. We feel like if we've set them up with all of the tools and the resources they need, we're now ready to, you know, succeed. And the belonging piece, that's where the teaching staff and the administrators are just critical, is creating that respectful and trusting environment so that those relationships can flow.
Those relationships ultimately are all centered around the student in the classroom. And I use student there, singular, not the students, the individual student. So my question kind of, as I'm thinking about what you've said there, is what's the benefit to students? Maybe it seems obvious, But what's the benefit to students when their families engage in the way you've described? And then what can families do to make sure students benefit?
We talk about funds of knowledge is a phrase we use a lot. And that's from Dr. Karen Mapp from Harvard has coined the dual capacity framework, which if somebody really wants to look into more of this, that is a great place to start. And it creates the system of how we think about family engagement in a really concrete way. But one of the elements of that model is what we call funds of knowledge. And funds of knowledge means that I have information as the parent, you know, my child, Jack, I know what makes him nervous, what makes him calm. I know what things he's interested in. I have information that you as the teacher could really benefit from that could save you a lot of time and heartache if we compared those notes. As a teacher, I don't have formal training in how to teach my fourth grader math. I have no idea. And I definitely learned that during COVID, that I need the teacher's formal training in how I coach my child. Or if you go to the middle and high school again, if I have a high schooler that's like, man, I'm not going to go to college. I don't have any interest in that. I may want to reach out to the teaching staff to be like, hey, how do I have these conversations with my teenager so that they are thinking about a certificate program or college after high school. So in order to have these kind of sensitive conversations, right, I'm talking about your teaching and you're talking about my parenting, we have to have a strong foundation. So I first have to trust you and you have to trust me if we're going to rally around this child. So family engagement really begins and it hinges on that mutual trust, respect, and relationship building.
Yeah, and you're making it really clear that either side can initiate that, but it's really important that we do so, that there's a willingness for parents to reach out, that there's a willingness for teachers to engage, and that everyone should be able to agree that students benefit when people do so.
You got it.
Yeah. My name's Gil Hunter. I am the interim dean for the College of Education and Applied Human Sciences. I've been talking with Brooke Gill, Senior Director for Family Engagement, Policy, and Practice with the Pritchard Committee. Brooke, thanks so much for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, sorting through confusion surrounding hemp and those adult use derivatives now out on the market, and a gathering aimed at teasing out the ideas that can shape the future of Eastern Kentucky.
We paused to consider if we should move forward with it and thought that it was more important to do now than ever.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supporting veterans through an honor flight to Washington, D.C. The public is invited to the Welcome Home Celebration on September 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the Bluegrass Airport. More at honorflightky.org. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Hemp as a potential successor to tobacco as an important cash crop took Kentucky by storm a few years ago. A lot has happened since then, and we're visiting with Jonathan Miller, General Counsel at the U.S. Hemp Roundtable, about moves underway in Congress to sort out the patchwork of laws, rules, and regulations pertaining to hemp in general and ingestible derivatives such as Delta 8 in particular. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And I'd like to begin by asking you to briefly bring us up to date. I know that while the 2018 Farm Bill supported the production and sale of hemp and hemp derivatives such as CBD, there have been public statements by FDA officials that it's unlawful to sell ingestible hemp-derived CBD products, and that took quite a toll on the industry. Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, the 2018 Farm Bill passes, and the Congress declares loud and clear that the hemp products like CBD should be legal. But the FDA comes out and says, well, we don't think so, but we're going to start developing a regulatory pathway to help make sure that these products are available for sale and that they're protected good manufacturing practices for consumers. But unfortunately, it's been nearly 4 years, and the FDA has not done anything of any significance towards this goal. And so it's resulted in tremendous disruption in the industry. It's hurt a number of farmers as prices have dropped around 90%. And consumers aren't being protected because, as anyone can tell, there are plenty of products on the marketplace that are being sold that aren't being monitored for their quality or for their safety.
Yeah. CBD is marketed as a non-intoxicating dietary supplement. And when you worked on the 2014 and then the 2018 farm bills, the underlying theme at the time was that hemp is non-intoxicating as opposed to marijuana. And then along came a market in Delta 8 products. Delta 8 is a form of THC structurally similar to Delta-9 THC, the major intoxicating ingredient in marijuana. But unlike its marijuana cousin, Delta-8 is federally legal and also legal in most states. So it seems to kind of muddy the distinctions. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, when we were lobbying for the farm bills, both 2014 and 2018, our mantra was that hemp is not marijuana. In fact, I joke that I almost went to the Fayette County Courthouse one year to change my name to Jonathan Hemp is Not Marijuana Miller, because I would talk about it with policymakers and bankers and social media companies, you name it. Mm-hmm. Folks were struggling with CBD because of the lack of FDA regulation. They figured out a way to convert CBD biomass to Delta 8, and Congress literally did not anticipate this. While we were trying to develop legislation that would put the demarcation line in terms of intoxication, most of us who were involved in that process didn't know what Delta 8 was at the time. So federal courts have determined that whether or not that loophole was intended, there is that loophole. And so you see those Delta 8 products being sold pretty broadly.
Well, fast forward to very recently, August 3rd, a Boone County court issues a permanent injunction prohibiting Kentucky State Police from taking any criminal action against hemp products with 0.3% Delta-9 THC or less, including Delta-8 THC products. And that case relates to the Kentucky Department of Agriculture's April 2021 letter that said that Delta-8 THC is illegal, and warning that actions involving Delta-8 THC could result in administrative and criminal penalties. The court's decision will likely inspire another legislative effort next year to regulate Delta-8 THC in Kentucky. What's the roundtable's position on production and sales of adult-use products that are derived from hemp?
Well, we don't have a problem with adult-use cannabis. We believe that as long as it's regulated appropriately and segregated from minors, that there certainly is value for a lot of people to intoxicating products. But where we have a problem, and a real problem, is the status quo, where you see these Delta-8 and now some intoxicating Delta-9 products being sold as hemp at grocery stores, at convenience stores, at gas stations, at vape shops, and we see story after story of minors ingesting the products, thinking they're candy, and going to the hospital. And so we think that there desperately needs to be legislation at the federal level, but certainly in Kentucky as well, that would segregate these products and regulate anything like intoxicating Delta-8 as adult-use cannabis.
Is that issue with kids getting into Delta-8 products, is that largely a packaging problem, do you think?
Well, there's packaging, certainly, and some of these products mimic popular candies or other popular products out there, which is disturbing, and hopefully there's efforts by the FTC federally to crack down on that. But it's also, you know, these vape shops and gas stations, et cetera, are getting revenue of it. So they're trying to sell it to as many people as possible. And under the law, it is legal. It's legal to sell these products to kids. We want to make clear that that should not be the case, and that while there certainly are appropriate marketplaces for intoxicating products, it's not at retail and it's not to minors.
So we're in the sorting out stage for all these products, I guess. And there was a recent congressional hearing. Eric Wang, the Hemp Roundtable's vice president of sustainability, is also the CEO of Echo Fiber. And at that hearing, he encouraged committee members to incorporate language into the 2023 Farm Bill that would regulate CBD and other non-intoxicating hemp derivatives as dietary supplements. And there also is proposed legislation that would limit the hemp products to only non-intoxicating compounds. Alcohol is legal. Are these hemp-derived products somehow more dangerous than alcohol?
No, but alcohol is strictly regulated. You've got a long-standing since prohibition program of taxation and of safety. There's regular checks that stores that sell alcohol products are not selling to minors, and they get fined if they're caught doing that. And we'd like to see the same thing for intoxicating products. Adults find value in these products when they're safely manufactured and when they're regulated strictly by the government. But that's not happening. And I should also mention that not all Delta 8 products, and certainly not all Delta 9 products, but some of them are manufactured in ways that are dangerous to public health. We hear stories about battery acid being used to manufacture Delta 8 products. And again, that's not going to happen if we have a regulated system that cracks down on that kind of behavior.
I've heard about something called the Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act. It's sponsored by Senators Schumer, Wyden, and Booker, I believe. What's that about?
So this is the omnibus cannabis legislation that has been long awaited that would legalize all cannabis and create a regulatory structure for its sale across the country. If you take a poll of the country, it has tremendous support. But right now, there don't appear to be that enough votes in the Senate. You need 60 votes, and even strong hemp supporters like Mitch McConnell, for example, oppose this legislation because it's more encompassing. The legislation has got a lot of quality to it, but it does have some real problems, particularly where it comes to the definition of hemp. It would define hemp products not at what its current level, which is 0.3% Delta 9 THC, but would go down to 0.0001 total THC, which would ultimately eliminate pretty much all hemp products from the retail market. So you'd only be able to get your CBD and non-intoxicating hemp products through dispensaries where you get marijuana. And so fortunately, this bill is just in the beginning stages, and we think there's going to be a lot of opportunities to amend and improve it. But that's a real concern to the hemp industry.
Well, I've heard that maintaining that limit on THC content at 0.3% has been a really difficult challenge for farmers. Actually, has caused many to lose their crops because they didn't qualify. Is that a real challenge?
Yeah, a couple of ways that we're trying to deal with this. Number one is we are focused on trying to raise the limit of THC in the field to 1%, and so that would be able to protect a whole lot of farmers who are having trouble finding growing CBD, and because of the climate or because of the soil, it spikes above 0.3%, and then they have to destroy it. The other thing we're doing, though, is we're really wanting to encourage the purchase of certified seed. A lot of times you see hemp spiking THC levels because the seed is bad. They've bought it from some source that wasn't trustworthy. Hear a lot of Chinese hemp seed being flooded in the market. And we would like to see real incentives being given to purchasing certified seed. In fact, we're working on legislation where if you purchase certified seed, you don't need to go through the whole testing rigmarole and fingerprinting and all the other stuff that's required for growing hemp. And so stay tuned. What we call the Value the Seed program is something that will be introduced and we hope will be part of the 2023 Farm Bill.
Back to that legislation I just mentioned, just for a moment, it makes me wonder, does that also open the door to more research into all cannabinoids?
There is certainly more research provided, and that's really needed. We have been just really scratching the surface when it comes to cannabis. We've gotten a lot of research in terms of the safety of CBD, but more is welcome. But we don't know anything about Delta 8. We don't know anything about some of these new cannabinoids, and that's why it's really important for us to research both the safety. Is it okay to take? But also, what's the efficiency? What can these products do to improve the health of Americans? We've heard a lot about it. We've certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence that people taking these products find benefits, cancer patients, others. But we need more research to really nail down what the health value is for these important plants.
That's Jonathan Miller, General Counsel at the U.S. Hemp Roundtable. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Anytime.
A lot of wheels are turning in the minds of people who know, love, and live in eastern Kentucky. There was a huge flood. It took lives. It destroyed everything in its path, including whole communities. And it revealed the need to think and think hard about the future of the region. One such gathering of minds is happening soon in Hazard. It's being presented by the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, a WEKU sponsor. And here with details of the Appalachian Big Ideas Festival is the Foundation's Chief Strategy Officer, Laura Smith. Welcome back, Laura.
Hey, Tom.
So planning for events like this on the scale of the Big Ideas Festival usually begins a lot of months in advance. Is that true in this case? And has the flooding of late July influenced what's on the agenda?
Absolutely. So we started planning for the Appalachian Big Ideas Festival last year, and have been working steadily on it all year up until the flooding happened in July. So as you might imagine, that threw a little bit of a wrench into our plans. We paused to consider if we should move forward with it and thought that it was more important to do now than ever. We were already going to be focused quite a bit on resiliency and kind of forward-looking strategies for the region based on our experience with the 2021 floods. So this is just, up the urgency of doing that and having those conversations.
Okay. Give us some details then. Some agenda highlights, dates, registration, accommodations for out-of-towners, that kind of information.
Yeah. Well, the Appalachian Big Ideas Festival is taking place in Hazard, Kentucky from Thursday, September 29th to Saturday, October 1st in downtown Hazard, Kentucky. The majority of our events are free and open to the public. And we're kicking off with our public programming on Friday morning, starting at 9:30. We have a series of community conversations and roundtables that will be taking a place across downtown Hazard in different locations, focused on everything from our work around community safety and justice to recovery and workforce development, LGBTQ+ issues in Appalachia, sustainable design, racial equity, community, place-based philanthropy, local agriculture, entrepreneurship, all kinds of things, creative placemaking. And those will be running continuously through the day. We kick off at 11 a.m. with our first opening keynote, and that's a very exciting Appalachian Writers Roundtable that will be taking place at the Art Station downtown, hosted by Robert Geip, and featuring Appalachian authors Nima Avashi, Ashley Blooms, Crystal Good, and Carter Sickles. There'll also be music and live public mural making throughout the day that people can watch or participate in. That evening, on Friday evening at 6:30, we have a keynote performance with MacArthur Genius Award winner, poet, prison reform activist, Reginald Dwayne Betts, that'll be taking place at the Forum. In addition to that, on that program on Friday, capping off with Reginald's performance, we also on Saturday have a very exciting announcement. Our new U.S. Poet Laureate, Ada Limon, will be joining us at 2 o'clock. And she will be in conversation with our Kentucky State Poet Laureate, Crystal Wilkinson. That'll be taking place at the Bill and Betty Morton Amphitheater, which is next to City Hall, downtown Hazard, completely free and open to the public. For those guests that are coming that would like to, we also are offering a food package that we call our Vittles Package. And that'll include some special meals that are happening on Friday and Saturday with regional chefs, farmers, and others, including Chef Kristen Smith from the Wrigley Tap Room in Corbin, Kentucky, and then a special collaboration between the Kane Kitchen in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and women who are involved with the Lee Initiative.
I know from going to these kinds of conferences in the past that even with a great agenda, it's even more than that. The opportunity to network is invaluable.
That's exactly right. And that's, we've tried to design this, our agenda, with lots of downtime, networking time, you know, and time for people to just really connect and talk. Many of us right now in the region are doing daily relief and recovery work, and we just have our heads down and we're focused on what is directly in front of us, whether that is for our work at the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, moving resources out into the hands of people, or all of our friends and colleagues who are out working in distribution centers or mucking out houses right now. And so we're really hoping by the end of September, this can be a moment where we get together, we take a deep breath, we eat some delicious food together, we enjoy great art together and music, and we can have some really meaningful conversations about what we've just been through and what is coming next.
All right. And again, you can get that information online at appalachianky.org/big ideas. Laura Smith, Chief Strategy Officer at the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky in Hazard. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you, Tom. It's always great to talk to you.
Earlier this year, Berea College music instructor Hanaro Rascon talked with us about the origins and character of mariachi music. And as you hear, he gave us a sampling. Coming up, an opportunity to celebrate the culture and traditions of Mexico through music, dance, and food. The Viva Mexico Festival is set for Friday, September 16th in Gardenside Plaza on Alexandria Drive in Lexington. And on the 16th and 17th, let your mind become the theater, the Wilmore Storytelling Festival, featuring some master yarn weavers, happening in the Pavilion on South Lexington Avenue in Wilmore. On Facebook, search More Tales Wilmore, one word. Thank you for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.